Then Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of Yahweh." And he said to the people, "Proceed and march around the city, and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of Yahweh." So it was, when Joshua had spoken to the people, that the seven priests, bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before Yahweh, advanced and blew the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh followed them. The armed men went before the priests, blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, 'Shout,' then you shall shout." So he had the Ark of Yahweh circle the city, going around it once. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of Yahweh. Then seven priests, bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of Yahweh, went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armed men went before them. But the rear guard came after the Ark of Yahweh, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did 6 days. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early, about the dawning of the day, and marched around the city seven times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city seven times. And the seventh time it happened, when the priests blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for Yahweh has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by Yahweh to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers we sent. And you by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take the accursed things, and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to Yahweh. They shall come into the treasury of Yahweh." So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. But Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, "Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her." And the young men who had been spies went in and brought her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of Yahweh. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before Yahweh who rises up and builds this city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates." So Yahweh was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Last week we read of Joshua receiving instructions from the Lord about the campaign against Jericho. And since that forms the backdrop to our passage tonight, I want to quickly read through Joshua 6 verses 1 through 5 to get that background. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And Yahweh said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times. And the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass when they make a long blast with a ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man straight before him." Tonight, we will read about how those commands were executed. And what becomes clear is that the old spiritual really has the wrong emphasis. it is not so much that Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Rather, Yahweh fit the battle of Jericho, incorporating Joshua and the people of Israel into his plan for victory. We'll walk through the text to see how it is that Yahweh brings this about with both his wrath and his mercy on display. Begin with verses 6 and 7. Then Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of Yahweh." And he said to the people, "Proceed and march around the city, and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of Yahweh." Now these first commands reveal that this is no ordinary battle plan. Orders are not given first to soldiers, but to priests. It is not military armaments that are central in the account, but the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, the Ark is mentioned three times in these two verses. We read of the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of Yahweh, the Ark of Yahweh. And everyone is to be arranged in relationship to the Ark. Let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of Yahweh. Let him who is armed advance before the Ark of Yahweh. As with the crossing of the Jordan River, the Ark signals the presence of the Lord with his people. And it sends the message that the victory will really be his, not theirs. Another link with the Jericho, Jordan crossing, is that the Hebrew word translated proceed in verse 7 means cross over. And it's actually one of the key words in chapters 3 and 4, speaking of crossing over the Jordan. And this just shows the ongoing unity and continuity in Yahweh's saving acts on behalf of his people. We continue beginning with verse 8. So it was when Joshua had spoken to the people that the seven priests, bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before Yahweh, advanced and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout." So he had the Ark of Yahweh circle the city, going around it once. And they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. I want to draw attention to one aspect of the wording in verse 8. In response to the command, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horn before Yahweh advanced and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh followed them. Now note what it says there. The seven priests blowing the trumpets are said to do so before Yahweh, which is then clarified as before the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. And once again, we see what we saw earlier in this book is this very close identification between the Lord and the Ark. And the point is, with the Ark, the Lord is present with his people. So let's get the picture in our mind. Central in the procession is the Ark. And the Ark here is again carried by priests. And you may remember that the same was said of the carrying of the Ark during the crossing of the Jordan. And when we read the law, we read that the Ark was ordinarily carried by Levites. It didn't need to be carried by priests. So the fact that it is priests who carry the Ark heightens somewhat the holiness of this event. Immediately in front of the Ark are seven priests, each with a ram's horn trumpet, and armed men march in front of them while other armed men march as a rear guard behind the Ark. Now imagine a Canaanite observing this from the walls of Jericho. Arranged in the prescribed way, the forces of Israel march around the city one time with priests blowing trumpets the whole time. It certainly would have looked like an odd military maneuver. In fact, it had more the character of a religious ritual, which in a sense it was. This was to be a holy war, a subject to which we'll return in a bit. And note another thing from these verses. The people were to be absolutely silent. "You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout." The picture is one of almost utter passivity on the part of the Israelites, at least for those first 6 days. Now, before we move on, here again the summary statement of the first day of the campaign in verse 11. So he had the ark of Yahweh circle the city, going around it once. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. Note, it doesn't say that Israel circled the city. It doesn't say the armed men circled the city. It said the ark of Yahweh circled the city, because that is really what was most important. This battle belongs to the Lord, who is associated with the ark. Well, then, picking up in verse 12, and Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of Yahweh. Then seven priests, bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of Yahweh, went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armed men went before them. But the rear guard came after the ark of Yahweh, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did 6 days. And these verses succinctly tell us that the same thing happened 6 days in a row. Each day the Israelites marched in the prescribed formation around Jericho once, and then they returned to their camp, probably at Gilgal. And surely the Canaanites were beginning to wonder what this was all about. Each day they observed this holy parade, but nothing else happened. There was marching to blowing of horns, and then the Israelites departed. And this happened 6 days in a row. And we know from Joshua's commands that this is all building toward the seventh day. But of course, the Canaanites didn't know that. Verses 15 and 16, but it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early about the dawning of the day and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city 7 times. And the seventh time it happened when the priest blew the trumpets that Joshua said to the people, shout, for Yahweh has given you the city. While on earlier days we're told that Joshua rose early, we're told that in verse 12, now we're told that they all rose early about the dawning of the day on the seventh day. And this may be because they needed more time to accomplish their 7 circuits around Jericho. And this is what they proceeded to do. Now once they started their 2nd circuit, the Canaanites must have realized that something was up, right? For 6 days, they'd watched them go around once and depart. Surely they expected them to go around once and again depart. But they went around again and again and again until they had circled around the city 7 times. And the number 7 seems to be very significant in this account. There's 7 days, there's 7 priests, there's 7 trumpets, there's 7 times around the city. As a number of completion, the number 7 likely symbolized the complete victory that Yahweh was giving them over Jericho. And Joshua's command after the 7th circuit pointed people to the source of victory. He says, shout, for Yahweh has given you the city. Now we might expect to read next that the people immediately shouted, but Joshua continues giving instructions. Now the city shall be doomed by Yahweh to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you, by all means, abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things, and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to Yahweh. They shall come into the treasury of Yahweh. These are instructions about what Israel is to do after the walls come down. And we should be honest in admitting that they strike us as pretty brutal. They are to destroy the entire city, killing all the people within it. They are to take no booty for themselves, only silver, gold, bronze, and iron to be taken to be consecrated to Yahweh for his treasury. The only human beings to be spared are Rahab and her household, in accordance with the promise given to her when she had earlier hid the Israelite spies. This passage and others like it in Joshua are favorite texts of the apologists of atheism. They declare that Yahweh is pictured here as a tribal god who is vicious and unjust to anyone outside the tribe who worships him. How could God possibly order the wholesale slaughter of innocents in Jericho? Such a bloodthirsty deity is worthy of no one's worship. Surely this God was simply the invention of cruel Israelites who wanted to justify their wicked genocidal acts. You ever heard anything like that? What are we to make of such objections? How can we understand the text in a way that would lead us in a different direction? Well, that brings us to the topic of holy war that we mentioned earlier. And we are not going to be able to do an exhaustive study of that subject this evening, but I believe we can make a start in understanding it in scriptural terms, which are the terms that ought to matter to us. While we certainly need to listen to the voices in our culture that raise objections to our faith, our ultimate concern is to know what saith the Lord. Well, let's begin with terminology. We read in verse 17, "Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction." And doomed to destruction employs the Hebrew verb, haram. And then in verse 18, we read, "And you by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it." And accursed thing is a Hebrew noun, haram. It's very closely related to the noun haram. And I introduce this mainly because you will sometimes hear about the Old Testament holy war referred to as haram warfare. They just apply that Hebrew word for what this is all about. A commentator, David Howard, explains the verb can be rendered to devote to the Lord, or to devote to destruction, or to completely destroy. And the noun can be rendered as devoted things or destruction. The NIV text note makes clear the connection between the idea of devotion and destruction. Quote, "The Hebrew term often refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them." Well, the terms are clear enough as to their meaning, but how did they fit into God's plan for his people and their enemies? Well, let's go all the way back to God's covenant making with Abram. Genesis 15 narrates that covenant making ceremony in which Abram was to slaughter animals and divide them to create a pathway between them. And you'll recall that the Lord caused Abram to fall into a deep sleep while he, in this vision of an oven, passed between the parts. And that sent the message that Yahweh was the one who would keep the terms of the covenant. Well, at that time, in the midst of this ceremony, the Lord gives Abram a glimpse of the future. We read this in Genesis 15, verses 13 through 16. "Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" Now the key verse here for our purposes is 16. After speaking of the bondage in Egypt and the deliverance from it that was going to come, the Lord tells Abram of his descendants, "In the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Now here was the promised land of Canaan. And the Amorites were one of the peoples in the land and probably represent all the peoples of the land in this text. And it speaks really of God's patience in not immediately judging the Canaanites, but patiently enduring until their iniquity is complete, until it reaches something of a breaking point. And so all the way back in the time of Abraham, the guilt of the Canaanites is given as a reason they will forfeit the land. Oh, we might ask then, of what were the Canaanites guilty? What was this iniquity? Well, we can look to a few passages to address this. The first in Leviticus chapter 18. This is a chapter we have visited recently in our adult Sunday school series. This chapter gives a list of laws relating to sexual immorality. And some of the sins that are covered by the law here include incest, adultery, homosexuality, and bestiality. And after these laws are given, Yahweh warns Israel about the nations in the land. Leviticus 18, beginning with verse 24. Do not defile yourselves with any of these things. Now, these are the sins he has just spoken of. For by all these, the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. For the land is defiled. Therefore, I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. Now, here the Lord explicitly states that he will drive out the nations from the land because of their defilement. And here, in context, it's specifically their sexual immorality. And we're told that their sin defiles the land so much that we have this vivid image of the land vomiting out its inhabitants. But this will be an act of judgment from the Lord. He says, I visit the punishment of the iniquity upon it. We have a similar passage in Deuteronomy chapter 18 that includes some different sins. Deuteronomy 18, beginning with verse 9. When you come into the land which Yahweh your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For all who do these things are an abomination to Yahweh, and because of these abominations, Yahweh your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless before Yahweh your God. For these nations which you will dispossess listened to soothsayers and diviners, but as for you, Yahweh your God has not appointed such for you. Sins in this passage include burning children as sacrifices and engaging in various practices relating to sorcery and witchcraft. And we read in verse 12, for all who do such things are an abomination to Yahweh, and because of these abominations, Yahweh your God drives them out before you. And the Lord particularly drove home this point to Israel to stress that their righteousness was not the reason that they would have victory in Canaan. Theirs may have been a relative righteousness compared to the height of the iniquity of the Canaanites, and yet they were not to be puffed up about that. We read in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 4 and 5, but do not think in your heart, after Yahweh your God has cast them out before you, saying, because of my righteousness Yahweh has brought me in to possess this land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is driving them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh your God drives them out before you, that he may fulfill the word which Yahweh swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So two reasons are given here for the coming dispossession of the land by Yahweh. First, the wickedness of the nations, which we've already heard much about. And secondly, Yahweh's faithfulness to his covenant promises to the patriarchs. Again, taking us all the way back to Abram. And he specifically wants Israel to know that they will not earn such victory because of their own righteousness. In fact, he goes on in the next verse, verse 6, to say, you are a stiff-necked people. Don't be proud. Don't think that I gave you this land because you're so righteous. No, it's just because of the utter wickedness of those I'm driving out. And by the way, you're not so great yourself. You're a stiff-necked people. And the Lord actually gives specific commands in advance to engage in this harem warfare. We find this in Deuteronomy chapter 20, which also provides another reason for this destruction. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16 through 18. But of the cities of these peoples, which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, just as Yahweh your God has commanded you, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against Yahweh, your God. Now the command here is quite specific. You shall let nothing that breathes remain alive, but you shall utterly destroy them. And a further reason for this is given in verse 18, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against Yahweh your God. So if we gather all these threads together, we can see a number of reasons for the destruction of the inhabitants of the land of promise. First of all, God promised to give the land to Abram's descendants. We came across the word inheritance. It was to be their inheritance. This was their promised land. Furthermore, God had been patient, only bringing judgment when the nation's iniquity became full. And then we saw, thirdly, that the wickedness of the nations was extensive and extreme. Let's not talk about innocence here. This was extreme and extensive wickedness. And their destruction was necessary to protect Israel from following in their sinful footsteps. And make no mistake, this is divine judgment. It's not the result of human enmity on the part of Israel. It's not just that one tribe was angry with another tribe. No, the Lord says, I am doing this. This is an act of my own. Now, the text we have examined help us to see Israel's holy warfare in light of a bigger biblical picture. Having said that, that does not necessarily remove all our sense of uneasiness about it. So I'll make just a few more comments before we get back to our main text. First thing is, if you read through the Old Testament and you read through other ancient Near Eastern documents, this was the nature of warfare of that day. And there may have been an element of condescension to the realities of the era in God's dealing with the nations of the land. He led Israel to fight just as the nations in that day fought. Secondly, and this is most important, Israel's status as a theocratic nation was unique in history. No other nation in all of history, before or since Old Covenant Israel, has been the Lord's special nation, as was the case with Israel in that day. And one of the things that this means is that no nation today could appeal to Israel's holy warfare to justify any kind of genocidal atrocities. There is much that was unique in the law to Israel, much that was unique to the way in which God displayed His holiness through Israel, that was only for that people at that time. And thirdly, perhaps most importantly, God is sovereign, and He has absolute power over life and death. His ways are above our ways, and we are called to trust Him even when we cannot understand Him. And as believers in Jesus, we have every reason to trust in the Lord and His goodness. Abraham once, in pleading with God on behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah, asked, "Will not the judge of all the earth do right?" And the answer is yes. The judge of all the earth will do right and has done right. So as distasteful as these things may be to us, we need to recognize that in their time and in their place, they were part and parcel of the purposes of Yahweh to redeem a people unto Himself. Well, let's return now to our main text in Joshua 6, picking up at verse 20. So the people shouted when the priest blew the trumpets. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. At the commanded shout of the people, the walls of Jericho fell down flat. Remember, this was not a military marvel, it was a divine miracle. It was only after the Lord brought down the walls that the Israelite soldiers actually were engaged in some activity as they entered the city to carry out the commands given to them. In a sense, theirs was really a mopping up operation rather than an attack. They obeyed the commands they had received to devote the city to destruction. But amidst this wrath, there's also a tale of grace. Beginning at verse 22, but Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, "Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her." And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of Yahweh. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. How fitting that Joshua sent the two men who had been saved by Rahab to save her and her household. And Rahab shows us the Canaanites could have responded in faith to Yahweh and been spared. Her incorporation into Israel was a sign of another promise of Abraham beginning to be fulfilled. Through his seed, all the families of the earth would be blessed. Rahab is an early token of the gospel going out to the nations. And that is what we are called to be about today. Not destroying nations in the name of Christ, but reaching out to them with the good news of the Savior. We are to love our enemies and leave vengeance to the Lord. Verse 26, then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds this city of Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates. And this was truly the word of the Lord through Joshua, as we learn in its sequel. We read in 1 Kings 16:34, in his days, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundations with Abiram, his firstborn. And with his youngest son, Segub, he set up its gates, according to the word of Yahweh, which he had spoken through Joshua, the son of Nun. Yahweh is faithful to his covenant. He is faithful to his covenant blessings and faithful to his covenant cursings. And the chapter concludes with a sign of divine blessing on Joshua. Verse 27, so Yahweh was with Joshua and his fame spread throughout all the country. Remember, the question at the beginning of the book was whether Joshua would be able to follow in the footsteps of the great Moses as the leader of Israel. And we see that Yahweh is the one who is making it so. Let me share a few thoughts in conclusion. I had a professor, an Old Testament professor in seminary. I think he coined this phrase. He spoke about intrusion ethics. The term is not important, but what it signified was that there were certain instances, especially in God's old covenant dealings, in which that which would happen ultimately on the day of judgment was thrust into history as sort of a picture of what lay far ahead. It was sort of a preview of the final judgment. We know that judgment is coming. We tend to not have a problem with that judgment. Surely the Lord has the ability and the right to give a preview of that judgment in history, in part to serve as a warning lest others enter into that judgment. And so one way in which we can see these kinds of things in the Old Testament is to see that they are a preview of a judgment to come. And they serve as a warning and thus an opportunity for others to experience grace rather than judgment. And we need to remember also that there was grace in this account. There was grace in the midst of wrath in the person of Rahab. And it was because the confession of Israel became her confession of faith that she was spared and ultimately incorporated into Israel. In this text, we see her outside the city as one unclean, but later on we see her actually brought in into the nation of Israel. And we can know grace amidst wrath through trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. It is the Christian confession of faith that is our own and is our only hope for being spared from judgment to come. For the Lord would look upon us just as he looked upon Israel and say, don't think your righteousness earned you my favor. You are a stiff-necked people, but I am merciful. I have chosen you to be the objects of my mercy. And once again, the story highlights Yahweh's covenant faithfulness. He is faithful to all his promises. And as we see that through the sacred history that we have in Scripture, we can have great confidence that those promises yet to come of our inheritance, not of a land, not of a piece of geography in the Middle East, but our inheritance in the new heavens and the new earth, is sure to come about. Because the Lord is faithful to his promises. And if you ever doubt that, then just remember, Yahweh fit the battle of Jericho.